And now, it's the Florida Spectacular Podcast, hosted by Kathy Celestri. Find Kathy on Twitter and Instagram at Kathy Celestri, CathySalustri, on Facebook at Celestri Kathy, and visit her website, greatfloridaroadtrip.com. Now, discover a Florida you never knew existed.
Hi, everyone, and welcome back to this week's edition of the Florida Spectacular. I am your host, Kathy Celestri. John Kyle has the week off to take his son to a super important international archery championship, which is not at all true, but we like to put those in here when he's not here, just so everybody can vicariously live through his son. His son actually does do archery, Davida. We did a whole thing about it. His little boy is very into it. He's an archery dad. So anyway, not why he's not here. He's actually not here because this is not our normal recording time. And we have you, Davida Breyer, as our guest, author of the angsty Florida teenage 80s wonderful novel called Sinkhole. I don't know if that's even how you want it described, but I loved it. I really enjoyed the book. We have a mutual friend, Brad Bertelli, who told me about it. But certainly more and more people are noticing it now. It seems to be getting a lot of attention. Davida, thanks for being here.
Thank you so much for having me. And I kind of love that everybody describes the book a little bit differently, which means that it's, you know, it's read differently. I think that's fascinating.
I think it depends. It's a very personal book. So I think you bring a lot of yourself to the book. Like for me, there were certain things about the story that hit about being a kid in Florida and a teenager in Florida at a certain time. And I am honestly, I love reading books set in the 80s, which it's just, I don't know if you've ever read Grady Hendrix. Have you ever read any of his stuff?
Yes.
My Best Friend's Exorcism, those books.
I didn't read that. I didn't read that one. I've read others.
Yeah. Well, I've read his horror store.
Yeah.
The IKEA one. Nothing to do with Florida, but My Best Friend's Exorcism was set in the 80s. And honestly, the exorcism was almost secondary to me. I just like that setting. So that part right there. And of course, I read your book and you're already one up on Grady Hendrix because you've set it in Florida. And that's also kind of my weak spot. How did you get the idea for this book? Well, first of all, why don't you describe the book for our listeners, since clearly everybody who's read it doesn't get it right because we all have our own interpretations.
Well, I will say that I thought I was just writing suspense, but it came to find out that it had a lot of different aspects and layers to it. So it is it's a coming of age tale. It has some suspense. There's some murder, maybe, you know, and it's really three teenagers and really feeling what they're going through in the 1980s in Central Florida. As they try to figure out who they are. And one of them is kind of a toxic person. And, you know, the impact of that on the lives of the other two. It has also been described as Southern Gothic.
Eco-fiction. Eco-fiction, huh?
Yeah.
Because of the sinkhole disturbance in it? I don't want to give away too many spoilers.
More, I think, because it is set in that wild Florida that is embraced instead of run from or ridiculed. I mean, I really tried very hard to show some of the really beautiful aspects of what Florida can be, unless you're terrified of the outdoors, and then maybe not.
Well, if you're terrified of the outdoors, Florida may not be the place for you.
Yeah.
I thought some of the more beautiful scenes in the book were when I don't want to give too much away because everybody who's listening to this needs to go buy the book and read it, not get it from the library. I love libraries, but that doesn't help Davida. So go buy the book. So not wanting to give too much away, but there are these beautiful scenes that take place in the trees. I don't even really think of it as the wilderness because to me, if they could walk there, it wasn't like they were in the middle of the Everglades, or at least what we consider the Everglades today. It was just kind of their backyard. Like when I was growing up, we had a creek that ran one block behind our house. And I was not allowed to play in that creek because my mother, we moved down from New York when I was seven, and she put the fear of God into me. She had me convinced that if I went anywhere near that creek, a copperhead was going to jump out and bite me. Now, copperheads didn't live in that area, but I think she was just trying to keep her kids safe. But all the other neighborhood kids would just go down into the creek and splash around and play. And I mean, that's the thing about Florida. And I don't know now so much because I grew up in Clearwater, which has gotten very urban or suburban. Outside, I think, of Pinellas County, it's not that hard to go find the type of wilderness you described in the book in your own backyard or like, what was it? A walk, right? Like just a mile or two. I don't even know in your mind how far of a walk that was. They would go and they would be by the lake and there were trees and they hang out and they would be hidden because you can disappear outside in Florida. That was one of my favorite parts. I have a question to you about not wanting to give away. You have this, the book of course is called Sinkhole, and the sinkhole plays prominently in some of the I guess the climax of the book. So, but is it based on a legend that is a seminal legend, or did you play with that a little?
Everything I read talked about the actual legend of the lake and where the book is set, which is Lake Estepona. The legend really does say that, you know, it is named. And again, I have no idea how much truth or not. Our mutual friend Brad, I'm sure, would take to task all of the local folklore without any proof of anything. But everything said it's a place where people have died here. And I started thinking about that. And what I could read, what I did research, what I could find out, and what legitimately 80s kids who had no access to the internet would have been told by well-meaning social studies teachers. So I tried to take how much I knew and how much a teenage mind could potentially build upon that and say, what if this is the legend? What if, you know? And so there's enough of a basis in what people believe. I won't call it the truth, but there's a basis in what people believe or what is reported in unsighted media that says this is, you know, this place, this is a dangerous place. And it is a unique lake. It is a unique ecosystem. It is this monstrous lake that is incredibly shallow.
Well, it was part of that. So Lake Estepona, for everyone playing the home game who maybe doesn't have the intimacy with Florida lakes that the rest of us do, that's in the Kissimmee River Valley. So it was really just part of a larger floodplain when the Everglades would just flow from, say, where SeaWorld is now down to Florida Bay. So yeah, it makes sense that it's this large, shallow lake, and also makes sense that in the 80s, you know, we forget there was no internet. There was, if you really wanted to know something, you could call the library. And the librarian would find out for you. But it's never been our strong suit to teach a whole bunch of Florida Indian history. And I use the word Indian because the Seminole tribe of Florida is one of the remaining descendants of those people. And that's their preferred word. But we've not been good at it. So it would have been just very easy for a teenager in the 80s to be told this was the legend. And how were they going to know? You know, they didn't have access to a tribal historian or Google or, you know, Creative Commons. Like, sure, that sounds great. And honestly, I don't know. When I was a kid, I loved that sort of stuff. I loved the intrigue and the mystery.
Yeah. And for me, the intrigue and the mystery, I mean, I was trying to do my research. I had picked my setting. I had found the lake and I had some ideas about, you know, some things and did wonder and did my research. I found maps that showed sinkhole, like where the areas in Florida were, and I tried to, you know, bridge the gap between fact and fiction as best I could. But for me, while I had already picked Lurita as my primary setting, I picked it because it was this tiny place in the middle of all the blue-green splotches in the center of the state. When I decided, they need the tree, I want to put it near water because Florida.
It's not unrealistic. Yeah. It's not.
Yeah. And I found that reference of that legend. And I found it repeatedly during my research and thought, place where people have died. Is there any greater sign from the writing gods that I am on the right path here?
I thought it was great. So have you been to Lurita?
I have.
Okay.
So I didn't grow up there. I did want a place a little bit more isolated than where I grew up, or places that I had lived. And, while I was working on the novel, I took a trip down, and it was every bit the place I hoped it would be, and more. Alligators and llamas, cows and, turkeys and alligators all side by side. I mean, it was that wild Florida that had really been overdeveloped where I grew up.
Where did you grow up?
I was born in Miami, and then we kind of started drifting around a bit, moving different states. But when we were in Florida, I lived in Perrine. I lived in a homestead.
Right, so South Florida.
South, yeah.
South Florida. So I'm really curious, what was that like Perrine in the 80s or even the 90s? I grew up in a very sanitized Clearwater experience, which is kind of the West Gulf Coast, Southwest Gulf Coast almost.
I mean, I still remember the house that we lived in when I was fairly young, probably up to about age 5, that it was bordered by trees still. And it was still, that was before the malls and before it was off of Flagler. And it was a short ride out to the Glades at night. I mean, I was never a sleeper, so we would go on rides out to the Glades all the time.
That's great.
So into the 80s in Perrine, I mean, 80s were a tough time, especially if you, in Florida at that time, it was a weird time and place. There were drugs, and you knew people's like family friends whose kids were getting involved and stuff. Where I lived, I actually was... I was bussed as part of an attempt to address some of the segregation issues. And so because I lived in an all Black neighborhood, I was actually bussed to wealthy white schools. So some of that jarring class experience were things that I experienced as a child in the 80s in Florida.
I wasn't bussed. I was able to go to neighborhood schools, but, well, I didn't like high school, so probably not the best representation. But I was always very aware of, I don't know if it's better now, feeling almost a class mentality, where I think you do a good job with that a little bit in your book, too, where there's the haves and the have-nots, and the bad things don't happen to the haves. They happen to the people who are poor or poorer. Yeah. So, where'd you get the idea? I know it. I hate it when people ask me stuff like that, but I have to know, where did you get this idea? Cause I love it so much.
The very core of the idea, the beginning point was looking around. I started working on the book in 2016, and my experiences with individuals in my life, my experiences thinking about politically what's going on, and wondering, okay, as an adult, we can go, wow, that is a narcissistic personality. But as a teenager, could you look at one and tell? Could adults look at one and tell? Could another teenager look at one and tell and go, this person is really, really toxic and is going to hurt me? And I didn't think so. And I was kind of curious to explore what a teenage narcissist would look like. And when you pair them with really vulnerable people, and how are they vulnerable? In what ways? And how does that impact? And so that was the first question is, what does a teenage narcissist look like, and who would their victims be? And it started out from that point. I mean, it started with the characters first and the plot second. So I took some time to get to know the three main characters and what their lives might be like before they really started impacting off of one another.
So I think you have a really strong storyline, and it surprises me to hear that the characters came first, but then it doesn't, because the characters are also very well developed. And in fact, nothing as extreme as what happens to your characters. But you talk about toxic people. When I was a teenager, I had a friend who was definitely toxic, and I didn't see it. And my mom hated her.
Mm-hmm. They always do. And
if she could find a way to ground me just so I couldn't be with her, she would do it. And as an adult, I see that now. And of course, reading your book, I'm like, wow, this is completely believable. But I do like the question you asked is like, can you tell? And I think as teenagers, of course we can. Our brains are still part pudding. They're not done yet.
Right.
But can the parents tell? And I think that unfortunately becomes, they might be able to tell, and how much they can do about it is unfortunately tied to how much time they have to do something about it, right? So when your priority is making sure that your kids have food and a place to live, then you kind of have to worry about that stuff second, right? Like you can't take time off work necessarily to make sure they're not hanging out with the wrong kids.
Well, and it also depends upon how sophisticated the toxic person or the toxic kid is. And I think that, I mean, my son had, I wrote this damn book and my son had a run-in with one and I missed it.
Do we call them toxic now or do we just call them bullies? Do we understand the difference or are we just labeling stuff as bullying now?
This was not a straight up bullying. This was someone who did the love bombing and who, you know, really sought to hurt him while pretending to be something completely different to us, to him. And they're here. And I think in some ways, you know, the more someone has and wants to give, the more danger it is for that person. And Michelle's loneliness and Morrison's loneliness makes them so vulnerable to wanting what Sissy pretends she can offer them.
And he has a little bit of a secret too for the 80s. So that makes him even more vulnerable, right?
Right. And in the book, I mean, I don't think that's a too big of a spoiler.
No, you know, but it's up to you.
You know, Morrison is comfortable with the fact that he is a gay teenager. He is not comfortable with how society is going to react to him in a rural part of the country, and that he is a teenage boy, and teenage boys, particularly in the 80s, are not going to be kind and understanding.
Teenage girls in the 80s are no better. I remember having, there was only one boy, young man in our high school who was openly gay. And people were horrible, just horrible. Mm-hmm. And it kept other people. But in your book, I mean, that's the thing you see is Sissy takes these secrets and they're like currency to her, right?
Right.
They're the currency. Yeah. If I have a secret about you, mm-hmm. I can, you can't get mad at me because what if I spill your secret? I mean, it's horrible.
And she also, in a way, not only does she, when she thinks she might be losing any sense of power with this, you know, that Morrison is gay, she takes ownership almost of him being gay. So she is the one who is embracing, saying, of course I love you, you're gay. And this is, I'm being an accepting ally. And she's not, she's being controlling.
Yeah, she's using it.
Yeah.
She was, yeah, she was deliciously uncomfortable to read. I think that's the best way to describe it. It's like anytime she was in a scene, it was like a pit in my stomach because I knew something unpleasant was going to happen. There was never a happy interaction. Even when they were happy interactions, you're like, there's a black lining.
You can see it. And you can see it clearly. And Michelle cannot.
And that's, I mean, that, I'm sure this still happens to teenagers today. I don't know how old your son is. And
16. You know,
so was he able to tell it was happening?
No.
Yeah. I mean, so that's not, unfortunately, something we've grown past. Yeah.
Yeah. And it was one of those things where, you know, after all of that had happened and he had finally read Stinkle, he was like, wait a minute, this is like exactly what happened. Like, it's like, yeah, they sometimes kind of have a pattern. You know, there was no murders. There were no murders.
Well, that's good.
Yeah.
there's definitely a pattern. I mean, you're talking about narcissism here.
Yeah.
You know, it's just interesting because sometimes you can, when you're on the inside, you don't see it. Like, for example, the friend I had in high school that my mom couldn't stand. She moved and we didn't stay terribly close, but she came to visit and she saw one of my other friends, very close friends. And this person is nice to rocks. Like, I could tell the minute they met, there was like a visceral reaction. And when she left, she just looked at me, she goes, "I don't like her. She's not good. She is not a good person." And I said, "Oh, I just think, you know, she's a little insecure." And within maybe a month, as an adult, I was like, "Holy crap, I can see what my mom was talking about. I can see what my friend meant." Yeah, I was like, this is it's unfortunate because when you're essentially teenagers are still children from a intellectual and development point of view, they can't see it. And I think that's probably what made your book so riveting for me, was that I could see things as an adult, but also still remember things that had happened to me as a teenager. And it was, well, you're lucky it was well-written because it was very uncomfortable.
Well, that was the part of what I tried to do too, was because it's told in flashbacks, Michelle is adult finally. Adult Michelle is finally thinking about this stuff and getting that perspective that she completely missed out on as a teenager. And that's her brain finally going, wait a minute. I remember this thing and it doesn't look like I remembered thinking it was happening or what was going on. Something doesn't seem right now. And I wanted to give that, I didn't want it just to be, you know, the time and the place. I wanted Michelle to be able to come back and go, wait a minute, something is really wrong here.
Well, and it was, you did it. The book does it from the beginning because there's actually a spatial journey, but it's also metaphorical because she starts out far from home and she's got to get there. And when you first read about it, you're like, God, why would she just not talk to her mother and her brother? I mean, what the hell? And you start just like cracks in the story. And at one point I thought, oh God, did she write an unreliable narrator? So I'm going to kill Brad if he made me read one more. Because I mean, it became a thing for a while, right? And there were some very good ones and some not so good ones. So thank you for not doing that. But that was where I was going. I'm like, something's not adding up here. I remember thinking she's either written a really not very secret, unreliable narrator, or there's something more here. And so not an unreliable narrator, obviously. The narrator's figuring it out too.
And it's her memory that's unreliable.
Well, her interpretation of her memory.
Her interpretation, yes.
So, but she is not. She is painfully honest about things, I think, at some point. I don't know if you expected this level of dissection of your book this morning when you said, "Yeah, I'll be on the podcast." But
no, but thank you, because it's, you know, I it helps me too to kind of in a way digest what I've even written when I see how it's felt and interpreted.
Oh, I really enjoyed it. I know that the newspaper that my husband and I own, we have a book club, and the woman who runs our book club, she's a college professor, and she had selected this book for the book club even before Brad had said, "Hey, my friend wrote this, you've got to read it." And she had reviewed it, or she didn't select it for the book club, I'm sorry. She had it set to review. And then I said, "Are you going to do it with the book club?" She's like, "I don't know." She said, "They've read so many things lately that were so dark, and I'm scared to read it." And she said, because it was really just, she loved the book, but she said it was one of those reads that you kind of read with your whole body. Does that make sense? It's not like brain candy. So, but she was afraid that the book was too intense for a book club. I'm like, "No, it's great. Make them read it." So,
I've got a reader's guide.
Do you? Can you send us a link to that so we can put it in the show notes for the podcast too?
Sure.
So the dreaded question for every writer, what are you working on now?
I am working on book two. I think I'm going present day, but I am coming right back to Florida. And
well, good.
I'm coming to, you know, I was thinking about it and the wild parts of Florida, I knew really well. And I wanted to highlight those and talk about those and Sinkhole. One of the other places I spent the majority of my time growing up were flea markets and antique markets. That was what my mother did. And I went with her every week and we bought and sold. And so that will be a good part of the setting for book two. I'm still narrowing down exactly where, but I think I'm going to stay somewhere in the kind of south central area.
Well, there's no shortage of great flea markets. There was a nautical market in Stewart I went to, and it was beautiful. It was just beautiful. In fact, we went through, I had a little Volkswagen Rabbit, and I was working on my first book, and I had to retrace the A1A route. And instead of taking the camper, we took my little Volkswagen Rabbit, and we saw this beautiful flea market. And we had just bought a house and kind of going for a nautical look outside. And we found all this heavy line. We're like, well, that would be perfect to rent. And I have this picture of God knows how much of it stacked on top of this Volkswagen Rabbit. Like you could feel the car dragging. But there's always interesting things at Florida flea markets and nautical markets and antique markets, because so many people move down here from somewhere else. And then either they downsize once they're here, or sadly, once they die, their kids have to figure out what to do with all this stuff. And a lot of times kids don't live here. So
it just ends up their house cleanouts.
Yes. Yes. In fact, I'm a president of the local history museum, and Florida has laws about artifact possession, and people will do that when their parents die. They'll just bring stuff by and try and give it to us. Like, well, they lived here, so take it. And we've had to tell the volunteers, hey, you have to treat donations like vampires. If you invite them in the museum, you can't get rid of them. You have to keep them outside. So there's a lot of weird cast-offs. So I imagine that's going to be very fertile for your book.
And the markets of my youth are gone. The Target stands in its place now. But
Well, there's some big ones, though. I mean, I don't know how far north you want to go, but there's like Webster. But yeah, the market that we went to when I was a kid is gone, too. It closed actually in 2020, the Wagon Wheel Flea Market. That was the big one. Devita, thank you for being with us today. I'm excited to tell people about your book. I'm so glad Brad Bertelli recommended it to me, and I'm really glad you're working.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you very much for having me. And, you know, thank you. I enjoy everything you're doing with the newspaper and everything. So thank you.
Well, thank you. Thank you. Yeah, this has been great. So thanks for being here today, Devita. And our guest today again is Devita Breyer, author of Sinkhole, which is a wonderful Southern Gothic, Florida Gothic suspense, angsty 80s novel. I think I piled everything in there. Go check it out. And we'll have a link to the reader's guide in the show notes. And we'll also have a little information about Lake Istipoga. I never know. I say it a lot, and I always feel like it's wrong. Anyway, thanks for being here. We'll catch you next time on the Florida Spectacular.